Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you to our lecture today with Sarah Kember. I just wanted to make one announcement before I introduce our speaker and get us started. I wanted to remind everyone that the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies is holding its last ESCEES lecture of the term next Tuesday with Professor Sujata Murthy, who is currently a visiting professor at the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies, and is also a professor of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Middlebury College. I may have gotten the order of that wrong, but anyway. She's going to be delivering the lecture, Viral Feminism, Rewriting Rape Scripts in Social Media, about her current research in India. So that's going to happen at 12:30 on Tuesday, April 7th. We invite you all to come. We just ask that you let us know you're coming because we also serve lunch and we'd like to have enough food. So take a look at our website and you can find out more about that. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Sarah Kember. She's come all the way from London. It's probably the middle of the night for her right now, and yet she's going to give us a talk. So we're very grateful to her for that. I want to say, too, that typical bio statements just don't capture how awesome Sarah is. All of the kind of the range of works and practices, numerous accomplishments and contributions that she has made, both in terms of her academic work, but also outside of the academy in terms of artistic production. But I'm going to give you one anyway. Just know that it's just scratching the surface of everything that Sarah does. Sarah Kember is a professor of new technologies of communication at Goldsmiths University of London. Her work incorporates the study of new media, photography, and feminist cultural approaches to science and technology, among many other things. I mentioned, too, here that she is currently a major figure in rethinking the future of feminist publishing and publishing more broadly, which she was so gracious to talk to us about yesterday in a seminar that we had. Kember recently published her first novel, The Optical Effects of Lightning, that came out in 2011, and a short story, The Mysterious Case of Mr. Charles Levy. In 2010, Kember also published an experimental piece called Media, Mars, and Metamorphosis that came out in Culture Machine, which she is currently developing into a film and transmedia project with Britt Ray. Her recently edited book, Astrobiology and the Search for Life on Mars, includes the full text of all of Percival Lowell's writing on Mars, as well as H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. Kember has co-authored a monograph with Joanna Zielinska entitled Life After New Media, Mediation as a Vital Process. Her other publications include Virtual Anxiety, Photography, New Technologies and Subjectivity, out on Manchester University Press, Cyberfeminism and Artificial Life, out on Routledge, and the co-edited volume Inventive Life, Towards the New Vitalism. She also co-edits the Journals of Photographies and Feminist Theory, among other things. Today's talk is titled Ubiquitous Women, Everywhere, Everywhere, Everywhere. I love the repetition and the difference at the same time. We're going to hold Q&A with Sarah after her talk. I want to remind everyone in this room that when you ask your question, you need to hit the red button on your microphone so that we can hear you. And then when you're done, you should turn it off. and after we have the Q&A, there will also be a reception to follow. So I ask you to please join us if you can stick around. So at this moment, please join me in welcoming Sarah Kember.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks for all coming out in the middle of the night. That's really good. Okay. So the premise for me is a lot of chat about things like ubiquity at the moment. And I wanted to say that it's kind of bothering me. I don't think it's a very effective chatting. I think it's problematic. I think there's trouble afoot. So given that I'm going to add to a fair bit of the chat now, I'll try and say what I think the trouble is. And I'll give an idea or two for how I think we might survive it or get through it in some way or another. Very often when we talk about ubiquity, we're talking about complexity at the same time. It's like they're kind of pals or something. And we assume that they're a done deal. We assume that, they're kind of objectively occurring phenomenon of media and technological worlds. You know, they just are ubiquitous. They just are complex. When we do that, I think we miss something, and I think what we're missing is how they work as concepts, kind of performatively, to make those worlds happen, and also to remake the kind of contemporary environment in the image of the past. So that they take us, ironically, I suppose, back to the old days, you know, some kind of notion of the good old days before ubiquity was actually a thing, and when things were, you know, significantly less complex than they are now. So I'm going to talk about ubiquity as the remaking of the past in the future, basically, as a means of containing potentially unlimited possibilities for women in domestic environments, in urban environments, in which women are becoming ubiquitous or everywhere, in at least, I'd say, at least these three senses of the word. So the obvious one, W-H-E-R-E, is kind of hyper-visible, you know, luminous. W-A-R-E, everywhere, that means kind of bound up with technology, and specifically bound up with this, what I'm going to look at today, the lustrous luminosity of specifically glass, smart glass technology. And then, of course, we have everywhere, as in wearables. And the regulatory role of wearables is predictable. It's oriented to the reproduction of women as sexual objects, and also simultaneously as sort of really hyper-productive, optimized, managed subjects. So I want to look at a kind of gendered configuration then, which is not done that often, I think, unfortunately, at the moment, of ubiquity, technology, and time. Yeah? So that's what I'm going to unpack in gendered terms, ubiquity, technology, and time. In order to highlight one thing, which is the remediation, if you like, of images and ideals from the 1950s. Yeah, and I think it is the 1950s. I think there's a 1950s thing going on at the moment in what I'm going to look at, futuristic industry visions of what our smart futures are going to be. Okay, you'll be thrilled, trust me. Then I want to talk about the strategic value of being indecisive, of not knowing stuff, of the kind of utter ambiguity, undecidability of feminist time telling. So the argument will be that there is a benefit to really not being able to tell the time, which is something, frankly, I struggled with at school. It's probably why I'm doing it now. Yeah? There's a strategic benefit to not knowing what time it is, or more specifically, what kind of time it is. Okay, so that's what I'll try and tease out. But I want to give you a taste of the trouble I think we're in. Okay, the trouble that's coming from these futuristic industry visions of our lovely and undoubtedly desirable smart futures. They're by Corning, they're by Microsoft, they're by Google, the usual suspects. I don't know if you have seen Corning's A Day Made of Glass. Have you seen Corning's A Day Made of Glass? It's a classic. It's a gem. It's, in fact, a YouTube sensation. With viewing figures currently, I think, in the tens of millions and counting. Okay, it's viral, as we say. So I should say that I regard these otherwise fairly trivial promotional videos as potent forms of storytelling. And it's not just to do with viewing figures that would make any conventional publisher really, really, really envious. Okay? Says the person who's setting up a press at the moment, really envious. Okay? The reason I think they're potent forms of storytelling is because they're kind of narrativized forms of enchantment. They are stories. They're told as stories, as a day in the life of. Actually, it's a day in the work life of a generic, normative, likable enough woman, in this case, who happens to be called Jennifer. Now, there seems to be a preference for names beginning with J. I haven't quite got to grips with that yet. I can't explain that to you, but I am prepared to use it in my parodies, which I'll come back to at the end. So let's say Jennifer, if she is called Jennifer, she gets up, she goes to the bathroom, where her augmented reality bathroom mirror, that's what you've got coming, opens five separate windows at once. And one of them is about today's rather hectic schedule. I think at this point she looks a little bit concerned, basically. She's just about to be told that her 9:30 appointment is at 8:30, and is that okay? So she drags up her virtual keyboard, and she's still in her pajamas, like. She's still in her pajamas, and she types, yeah, sure, I don't mind. 8:30, good, I'll be there. Sends it off with a flourish, right? On her architectural, I don't know if you can see that, architectural display glass, pristine surface, electronics enabling, and touch sensitive. The classifications will be important as we go along. Later in the day, Jennifer's all dressed for work, but she actually goes shopping for clothes, modelled by these very cute pint-sized rotating avatar things that are basically, I think, the 21st century equivalent of all of the mirror reflections that populated 19th century art and 19th century literature. There's this fantastic book by Isabel Armstrong called Victorian Glass Worlds, and in it she argues that women have always been captured in glass. Yeah? Women have always been captured in glass. But what I'm interested in at the moment is the degree to which women are being captured, not in glass, if you like, but as glass, which is itself becoming, in these lexicons of smart glass, ultra-thin, flexible, entrepreneurial, responsible, and terribly hard-working. And this glass seems to me to be going to work as Jennifer, in some ways, in place of Jennifer. And we know that technology has always compensated for perceived failures, perceived inadequacies in female productivity, in female reproductivity. As we used to talk about back in the day, when things like new imaging technologies and new reproductive technologies, or as I think I referred to them in my first book, NITs and NERTs, were new. Yeah, we've always understood that technology is compensatory in that way and interventional in that way. So while Jennifer's screen presence, her holograms, her virtual video conferencing self, gets to the office, what she gets to do is pick out the applique ruffle blouse and check herself out in the mirror in a kind of old school fashion. And then back at home in the evening, she's wearing her new top and she sits down on the sofa with the kids, who are watching something cosmological on their 3D TV display glass, vivid and immersive, thin and lightweight, frameless design. And while they're doing that, and the planets are orbiting around them, Jennifer's husband or partner, and there's a couple of things on that. Firstly, husbands and partners in these scenarios are invariably not named in the ways that the female protagonists always are. So they kind of, if you like, evade capture in these normative narratives, in these histories, his stories of glass, becoming in a sense as transparent as the glass itself, becoming so that they just are. Right? But I'm not so inclined to let them off or leave them out, so I've kind of named them all the way through as the alliterative other half of whoever it happens to be, and it's very often Jennifer or Janet, so, you know, Jeremy or John will do. So let's just say husband or partner Jeremy, and guess what? Jeremy's a brain surgeon. Just so we know, Jennifer goes shopping for clothes, Jeremy is a brain surgeon. By day, by night, he lies in bed reading H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, of course, on his portable display glass, ultra-thin, flexible electronics enabling. Okay. And Microsoft's story is similarly invested in this alignment of productivity with future glass worlds whose likelihood of coming about is by no means contingent on Google's success, Google's failure with regard to, I must say, what other people have referred to as glass holes, and I don't know how that slide got in. It's nothing to do with me. Microsoft's story, it begins very similarly with a businesswoman, a very immaculate, smartly dressed businesswoman who's being picked up from Johannesburg Airport at 4 a.m. So it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And she sends a love heart to her daughter, who's missing her, clearly, from her translucent glass phone and pins it virtually on the kitchen wall at home. And then she gazes out of her, in this case, augmented reality car window, which highlights a building. It's giving a countdown to her arrival at her hotel at 4 a.m. These countdown clocks, as well as international time difference clocks, increasingly finely grained to the second measuring of time, is really widespread in these sorts of stories. Right? So the clock is counting down her arrival to the hotel. She gets this appointment location by highlighting a building. It says, your appointment tomorrow is here. Okay. So it's a 9-hour flight. She's still in the car. She's asked to review a proposal. She does it the minute she gets back to the hotel. It's not face down on the duvet. It's work the minute she gets there. And we find that Microsoft have happily added the hologram function to Corning's glass type so that the cloud that connects, she's called Isla, she's probably the one exception to the J rule that I've come across. Yeah, the cloud that connects Isla to her proposal literally floats in the air here, so I thought that was nice. And this proposal that she's working on, the green wall proposal, this comes on a thin flexiglass tablet, and it's next to her seemingly ubiquitous agenda. Right, so she's cutting, she's pasting, she's connecting, she's using a combination of touch and gesture and voice-activated software. And the thing to note on that is the technology that's missing, the one technology, actually, that isn't there in these smart environments that are haptic, that are gestural, that are intuitive and immediate, is writing. I suspect that writing is the technology that is erased quite actively in these environments, and that's something I want to come back to. She's only ever a virtual presence at Project HQ. Her male colleagues are reviewing all kinds of visualized data. They're ensuring that this proposal is geared towards sustainability, towards efficiency. But just like Jennifer, Ayla doesn't ever quite get to work, despite having a professional profile, despite having a hectic schedule. And her return home is signaled, in a sense, in this video by the presence of her daughter at home, at the kitchen table, doing a maths homework, and preparing to make something for the bake sale. So the note for me here is the slightly nostalgic Instamatic image and the faded handwritten typed recipes that are in the picture. So very, very much like Corning's, this Microsoft's kind of somewhat reactionary vision of a future that looks really much more like the past, yeah, is consistent with a housewife turned working mother as a figure of containment through openness, or rather through the enclosures that are the constitutive outsides of so much openness, so much reference to transparency, and so much glass, right? Which is all part of the same claim, I suspect. So glass technology opens out into a world of possibilities. They are social, cultural, communicative, they are ecological, they are economic, and personal and professional. And really very much like glass itself, those possibilities suddenly cease being fluid. Yeah? They become increasingly actually demarcated and delimited. They become effectively novel variations, novel categorizations, too many categorizations, suspiciously many categorizations of glass here. Just these new ways of marketing what is effectively, I suppose, the same old thing, right? Glass is a very old technology. And the housewife and working mother, as we know, is an old, established regulatory technique. I was interested that my colleague, Angela McRobbie, she picked out Deleuze's reference to luminosity, this kind of softer, more touchy-feely form of panopticism, in order to account for this increased visibility and scrutiny of young women, with particular reference to future productivity. So they're prepared, yeah? For through our usual regimes of self-management and care and self-improvement, for a presumably open, accessible, transparent, and egalitarian home life. And we should probably acknowledge that in these kinds of stories, Jeremy's cook. So a presumably egalitarian home life and workplace, which somehow, in the case of both Jennifer and Isla, returns them before they even get there. Turns them back, and I wanted to use that phrase, turns them back, through its connotations of a spell. Right? So hang on to the connotations of a spell. They are turned back, as it were, into housewives, consumers, and mothers. And what we retain, what we keep, is primarily their kind of grotesque, metamorphosed substitutes. And I'm using grotesque in the sort of literal and literary sense of the word. In the fairy tale sense of the word, if you like, where the grotesque is a thing that's become another thing. I think there's a Cinderella story here. You know, it's about scullery maids becoming princesses. It's about glass slippers becoming glass feet. Ultimately, what I'm seeing in these stories is glass transforming itself into a smart subject. It's transforming itself into a subject that is ultra slim, that is flexible, that is entrepreneurial, intelligent, interactive, and pristine. It becomes its own pristine, smart subject. And what we have of Jennifer and what we have of Isla is, in effect, their digital doppelgangers, their virtual skins, and this luminous, lustrous glass presence. And this adds value to products, clearly. We know about what it does for smartphones. But it also adds a sort of soft porn, soft focus scrutiny to women, who then, for me, are everywhere in all three of the senses of the word that I've evoked, including, not least, WEAR wearables. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that. I don't think there's been a great deal of chat about the conjunction so far of women, wearables, and work, and I thought I would highlight how this focuses on bras and pants, basically. Well, it does. Jennifer and Isla's they've professional profiles. They have daunting to-do lists. They have millions of contacts. And they have health check apps. Right? The ubiquitous health check app. So we're dealing with health checkers, fitness trackers, smart bands, the sort of stuff that's associated with the phenomenon of life logging and self-quantification, which is oriented towards the, I suppose, superficially sanctioned, but increasingly obligatory obsession with measuring personal data. So the closer and closer monitoring of personal data, the sharing of personal data, this is all associated with a trend. It may even be a movement. It's called the quantified self movement, and it has a motto, as all good movements do, and it is self-knowledge through numbers. And the idea is that the exam in life is associated with data points, quite simply that. It's blood pressure, heart rate, BMI. Yeah? It's quality of exercise, quantity of exercise, the extent of our social media interactions, our real interactions, all of this, and more, and more, and more. We add it up. The idea is we're going to know who we are. Right? And in due course, it goes on, this quest for self-knowledge through numbers, or for me, through algorithms, through algorithmic forms of self-regulation. This will extend, we are told, through gamification techniques from contexts of leisure to those of work. So these techniques of gamification, I'm sure you've heard of, they're about workplace gameplay scenarios, you know, imaginary game scenarios for working. And naturally, they're oriented towards measurably enhanced productivity, measurably enhanced performance and efficiency and transparency as the hallmarks, of course, of neoliberalism. But my point is that the data subjects that correspond to this apparently universal category of a quantified self, for me, are becoming increasingly and much more visibly redifferentiated in the forms, you know, the usual young, white, middle class, heterosexual of ubiquitous women. They're becoming gendered. Sorry. I haven't switched off. Have I? No. Yeah, okay. So this prominence, visibility, this scrutiny, the becoming ubiquitous of women in environments that do incorporate popular culture, but certainly exceed popular culture. So they definitely, for me, include precisely the kind of promotional videos by glass manufacturers that go viral on YouTube. Right? The rise in visibility corresponds with, is associated with, by Angela McRobbie, the disarticulation from La Clower Move, yeah, the disarticulation of feminism from other social movements, and ultimately on its undoing. So McRobbie argues that in place of feminist futures, we get a load of post-feminist substitutes coming out of this new hyper-visible feminine consumer culture. That's McRobbie's argument. And even to the extent that we want to make the argument that feminism is back, right, that it's being reintegrated in mainstream culture, in educational culture, in political culture, there's still, for McRobbie, a price to pay, a kind of punitive reaction that effectively curtails a feminist politics and ethics through precisely individualized injunctions to gendered forms of self-optimization. So for for McRobbie in The Aftermath of Feminism, for Laura Bates in Everyday Sexism. This substitution, this effective containment of feminism, is marked by a veneer of equality in the context of employment, of education, of consumer opportunities. And it's also marked by a kind of knowing, jokey, ironic form of sexism that gets passed off as banter. And I do think that this argument comes through for me in these contexts. The post-feminist disarticulated, very generically differentiated visions that are on offer by Corning, by Microsoft, etc., etc. I do think they offer us a veneer of equality. They do it by very consciously following girls to school and consciously following women to work, while foregrounding, actually, their consumer opportunities. Yeah, in the new economy, the shiny glass economy of new communications technologies, which is kind of very forcibly aligned with the old economy, which is kitchens, blouses and cakes, basically. And they come together in these futuristic visions. So women's ubiquitous glass presence, their bathroom mirror reflections, their holograms and all the rest of it, manifest them, of course, as intensively managed subjects, you know, within a governmental regime. It's about gendered biopower. And the difference that I see is that while Corning and Microsoft deal with largely desexualized, luminous, lustrous women, largely desexualized images, there are startups, there are not altogether unrelated industries that are trading in much less sanitized, much more overtly sexualized, much more ironically sexist, and manifestations of ubiquity that include unregulated online media practices. They include exactly what Anita Sarkeesian talks about, the use and abuse of women in as environment, as furniture, as background in computer games. But in the world that I live in this kind of wearable technology, smart technologies, I'm afraid there's just more stuff adding to that at the moment. And so what we get, as if we already hadn't enough, is Durex Thunderwear, which is basically smart pants controlled by smartphone apps. And these vibrate, I quote, whenever your partner decides you need some sexual attention. So sites like this, new sites like this, they contain a lot of kind of video stills of women, obviously, everywhere-ers, of smart pants. And they invite their viewers, their readers, whoever they are, to contribute slightly witty and inappropriate comments. And then we have Microsoft Smart Bra. Microsoft Smart Bra, it's for measuring mood. Okay? It's a reason. So they emphasize the health benefits, yeah, stress detection. They're emphasizing the health benefits of preventing stress-related overeating by using integrated sensors that will monitor your heart rate and your skin activity. Meanwhile, we have a spin-off company. It is going to get worse. It's a Japanese lingerie brand, so you're going to see how it's going to get worse. They're promoting the idea of a chastity bra, which naturally is ideal for Cinderellas everywhere, and remains locked the vast majority of the time until Prince Charming, who was evoked very directly, comes along and the wearer's heart rate reaches a level that is pseudo-scientifically associated with true love, and then, I quote, hey presto, the whole thing flies off. Or, I'm quoting, it dutifully bursts open with a gleeful spring, saving clumsy fumbling in the bedroom, and potentially taking his eye out in the process. Right. So there's nothing inherently new about any of this, right? There isn't. There's nothing new about even the apparently automated, algorithmic objectification, sexualization, desexualization of women's bodies. The fact that the smart bra works, and I frankly very much doubt that it works, and that's a thing, yeah, to hold on to this technology is absurd on so many levels, not least that it doesn't usually work. But say it works, okay? Through a combination of sensors and algorithms and apps, through the reductive metricization of affect and emotion, yeah? This doesn't change the game at all. This is just extending. This is just intensifying the reach of gendered biopower. And so this remains our problem. Yeah. And is it, to what extent is it a problem that is becoming further entrenched, that is becoming more unreachable in contexts, in environments, in which, arguably, feminism is undone, not just through jokiness, not just through illusions of equality, but through, if you like, internal disarticulations or internal oppositions, internal dialectics. So what I've been doing in this book I'm working on at the moment, it's called iMedia, The Gendering of Objects, Environments and Smart Materials, what I've been doing is looking at dialectics of structure and scale, of epistemology and ontology, and of objects and relations. Now, specifically, I've been concerned with the extent to which we are witnessing another turn. We have too many turns, right? I should ban it. If I was really at the UN, I would banish turns, okay? Conceptual turns, they don't help any. And so what I'm thinking we're seeing at the moment is a turn from a preoccupation with epistemological structure to a fascination with ontological scale. Yeah? Multi-scalar stuff. We don't want to talk about subject-centered humanism. We're post-human now. We are, in a sense, in a teleological sense that's very disturbing, after the human. After the human, we have objects, environments, and materials as things in themselves. Do we want to do this? I put it to you. I don't. I associate it with a certain recourse to science, to scientism. I really think there's a lot of physics envy. I think it's partly because of the, you know, they discovered the God particle. I mean, who wouldn't be jealous? You know, there's a lot of physics envy. There's a scientism, and that's always allied to masculinism. I think we have the problem, exact problem, that the radical feminists of the 70s were talking about when Xavier Gauthier, for example, wonderfully phrased it. For me, wonderfully phrased it. This frightful masculine fashion of speaking in order to be right. A situation she finds ridiculous, yeah, and that feminine writerliness and feminist writing were designed to destroy, right? So until or unless we get that stuff back, and guess where I'm going with that, what we have, I think, at the moment, is a lot of discovery. We have the rediscovery of the real, after the split of real and ideal. It's coming to us, it's being presented to us very generously in a benign and masculinist way within ecological and archaeological approaches to this sliding scale media, multi-scalar media. And we're getting it through a range of object-obsessed or technically oriented philosophies that I gather up in this book and very rudely refer to as oops thinking. Okay? This is oops thinking. And rather than kind of go on about it now, because I'll just rant for the next half an hour, I want to look at how this particular dialectic I'm concerned about, which is structure and scale, I think it's flipping, yeah? And that was really never the point of critique, how that kind of implements, how it organizes fundamentally different conceptions of time. And so in doing that, I'm saying that time is at stake in these environments of ubiquity. And that feminist time-telling is of real strategic significance in doing something, in confronting this ridiculously, ironically sexist configuration of women and wearables and work. Okay? So it becomes about a question, which I really, really think we need to keep open. We do not need to answer this question. We need to stop trying to answer this question. So, co-constituting, I think they do, as I'm arguing they do, the objects, the environments, the materials of contemporary media and technology. Ubiquitous women, this category that I've made up, are emerging both as time and in time. I'll try and explain the difference. Emerging as time and in time. Okay? Emerging as time, women come to matter, they materialize, they signify in potentia. As subjects affirming, you know the Karen Barad phrase, the multiple relationalities of becoming, of which we are a part. Yeah? So emerging as time or potentia, defined by Rosie Bradotti as the desire to become, yeah? Women are construed as primarily ethical subjects, open to multiple minglings, multiple interactions with beings, with forces that are beneath, beyond, below, above, the scale of human perception. So time as potentia brings in the scalar approach and ousts, it seems to me, in a way that's not helpful, the conventional, measured, clock structured approach to time. Okay? So we're getting a shift from scale in favour of scale, away from structure. So the subject in a scalar approach to time is a process, yeah? It's a becoming. It's not becoming anything in particular. It's just emerging as part and parcel of this generative process of life. And time and life, of course, are synonymous for vitalist philosophers like Brodotti, like Elizabeth Groves, who talk about apersonal, impersonal forces, that's vital forces, disrupting identity formation. Okay? And reintroducing, now I question whether reintroduction is necessary here, but reintroducing in their framework nature into the cultural realm, matter into discourse, and precisely ontological scale into our habitual epistemological structures of gender, race, class, and sexuality. And it's through to this notion of time as potential that both of them, both Rosie Brodotti and Elizabeth Groves, put up, offer us, an alternative affirmative feminism. Yeah? An alternative affirmative feminism beyond, and this is the argument, it's not my argument, beyond the humanistic confines of identity politics. Now, I'm steeped in that philosophy, and I don't want to equate their arguments or simplify their arguments. These arguments for me have been and continue to be and will always continue to be an incredibly rich and inspiring resources. I'm sure they are for you too. But I do think that in insisting on this notion of affirmation as an alternative, this openness to potentia or faithfulness to potentia as an alternative feminism, that's where we get opposition, that's where we get dialectics, wrought significantly from a non-dialectical impulse. And that will be significant to where I come in. So Brodotti sees her project of affirmative alternative feminism as a relocation project, a rebalancing project, yeah? Takes critical praxis from a necrological to a non-necrological perspective, right? But this relocation project, which builds on post-structuralist accounts to subjectivity and post-structuralist accounts to divisions between, for example, criticism and creativity, then becomes instead an advocacy project, and that's where I think it goes wrong. So advocacy in favour of affirmation, a future politics, an emergent politics, this takes place in relation to sets of assumptions about the present, right? About the violence of the times. And it takes place in relationship to assumptions about the past, about previous, earlier modes of inquiry, characterised through collective mourning and melancholia. So in short, a social and political theory that has allegedly placed too much emphasis on precarity, too much emphasis on vulnerability. This can and should, for Brodotti, for example, be replaced, be balanced, then replaced, by one that emphasises instead relations, endurance, radical immanence, and so on. But I think we need to be careful, and I think we need to note an inconsistency, for example, in that this affirmative alternative rests on precisely the kind of structured approach to time, simply past, present, and future, that it otherwise tries to get rid of, and that it builds on a deconstructive criticism that it otherwise deems to be far too negative. And those moves need to be exposed, I think, because they are inconsistencies. So again, it's about, for Brodotti, relocating the work of critique from a negative to a positive, from a present condition to a future set of possibilities and alternatives. And this rests on a time continuum that indexes the present on the possibility of thinking more sustainable futures, and for me, it fails to move beyond dialecticism because it restores in the attempt to abandon oppositional thinking. We get affirmation as an alternative, as an opposite. We do not get it, for example, as the constitutive outside of negative affects, which arrest movement, which block becomings, which freeze us kind of on the spot, as it were. So these negative affects for Brodotti, it's almost like she's asking us to do something quite magically transformative again, to transform them, to transcend them even, yeah, through what might be, for her, in her words, an act of faith in the power of life itself, an act of faith in potentia. It's a tough ask, I think. And Elizabeth Groves, similarly, goes for this vitality of potential, this affirmative alternative feminism, through a more radical opposition to critique as negative defensive affect. And it's interesting for me because I put together critique and writing quite a lot. And for Elizabeth Gross, those two things need to be prized apart. And I think she's doing that because then you can use a quest for inventiveness, a quest for creativity that's detached from and denied to the critical tradition. I don't think we need to do that. I don't think we need to detach inventiveness and creativity from the critical tradition. For her, writing is an affirmative alternative to the usual critical gestures. For me, writing is a manifestation of the usual critical gestures. We do not need to abandon critique to reach for creativity. We don't. Okay. Gross puts forward an idea that you can leave critique, that you can abandon critique. It's a non-critique. For me, abandoning critique is in danger of being a limited form of critique. Okay. A dialectical form of critique. It's predicated on substitutions, a substitution of this for that, of alternative concepts of time, structured and continuous. And in the same way as Bridotti, it's predicated on restorative strategies, deconstructive strategies, balancing out, that turn back into oppositional ones. Advocacy, in favour of ontology instead of epistemology. Ultimately, I think what happens in Liz Gross's argument is that we get nature installed once more as the foundation of culture, and I think that's a problem, okay? So it's, of course, in her attempt to abandon, to distance herself from, of course, the inevitability of binary structures, that this foundationalism comes into play. And Derrida acknowledges the tenacity of binary structures, yeah? They continually restore themselves. He offers us a strategy through writing for how to unsettle them, for how to displace them, you know? For shaking them up. But he's got this kind of movement, and it goes reversal, displacement, and then the pursuit of new provisional terms. And for Gross, and she acknowledges, this is really useful for a range of political projects, not least of which is feminism. We have to remember, of course, you know, Donna Haraway's predilection for new provisional concepts, for nature culture, female mind, material semiotic, and all the rest of it, which persist, I think, even as she begins to set up some degree of opposition between deconstruction and dreaming. And I don't want to see that opposition between deconstruction and dreaming. For me, that's problematic. So Gross acknowledges, in short, the value of deconstruction to feminism, and then declares a preference for vitalist philosophical traditions, through Bergson, through Deleuze. Now, I wrote this book called Life After New Media, Vitalism and Media. So it looks very much like I did exactly the same thing, that I declared a preference with Joanna for a vitalist tradition. And it's true to an extent that we did take seriously in this book a temporal account of media and mediation, a vitalist account, but it was confronted with the critical tradition in order precisely to better account for and better understand the instrumental, interventional moment of the cut, yeah, of decision-making, and therefore of alternative forms of decision-making, along with their attendant costs and their attendant consequences. So this wasn't, in a sense, going with the flow, the vitalist flow. And I think what Gross gets out of doing that is a reconstituted ontology that enables her to talk about the becoming of politics, including feminism, right, as well as nature. But at the same time, she installs this ontology as the ground of knowledge practices. Okay? And that is more problematic. Naturally, of course, this alternative conception of time, which I'm saying is structured time and continuous time, is inherent in the vitalist tradition. So for Bergson, structured time, clock time, lived time, is spatialized. It's a necessary, expedient, instrumental cut into continuity, into the flow of time as life, as time as creative evolution. So structured time emerges as something atomized, organized, mechanistic, it's all chopped up, and finalistic, goal-orientated. It's oriented towards teleologies of progress, of performance, of productivity, and of potential. So what I'm saying, and I think that axis needs, and if we're going to allow for a feminist construed as oppositional. Yeah? So that these two different approaches to time that we seem to be dealing with at the moment, one is potential and about managed and optimized time. The other one is potential, which is time as life. These are actually co-constituted, right? And we shouldn't choose on the basis set folks. All right. So my worry is, in short, that if we keep making these choices, potential or potential, managed time, optimized time, productive time, and something more oriented to emergence and evolution and creativity, if we keep carrying on doing that, and we go for these substitutions, and we go for these alternatives, and we go for these oppositions, what we end up with is a limited feminist critique, not a non-critique, not a relinquishment of critique. That doesn't work for me, okay? I think if we try to critique within our critiques, do you see what I mean? It's a bit like writing about the end of writing. It's been done. It's a bit like men declaring the end of men, which I think they have a tendency to do when they are male theorists of the Anthropocene. For example, I hear too much men declaring it's the end of men, and I think, really? No, it's Maureen McNeil has written that all this is a little bit disingenuous. Okay, so if that's what we're doing, and the cost of that might be that we end up with a slightly impoverished feminist political theory, then I suggest that a slightly more effective approach to understanding and to doing something, to addressing the new ubiquity of women might be predicated on cutting again and against, intervening, right, from within, not opposing, but intervening from within, creatively and critically, in the cuts in potentia that industry as a form of governance keeps on making by micromanaging women in time. Okay? So I put that, I'll rephrase that as a question. Oh, it takes us back to our lovely stories. How might Jennifer's bathroom mirror schedule or Isla's car window countdown be countered, be reversed, be provisionally refigured? Is there a time machine for women? I think that's a juicy question, actually. Is there a time machine for women? And I don't want to preclude anybody's questions, but I'll try and answer it if you want. In a minute. Is there a time machine for women? Answer in a second. If time is the mechanism, if glass is the material for openings and closures, which I'm suggesting that they are, what can writing, as a queer feminist practice that is both affective and interpretive, do or make of them and make with them? And I'll bore that question down even further, because it's not my question, because it's been asked before by Ellen Sisu, and the question is, what can writing still do? Okay, I'll answer that as well if you want, or I can leave it open. So when it comes to writing, I experiment with it myself a fair bit, and the reason I do this is because I think it is both a deconstructive and reconstructive strategy. I think it's about wording, and I think it's about worlding. And I think what's great about writing is that it will not be resolved into divisions, such as feminism and queer theory, such as negative and affirmative. It won't fit in those oppositional structures. And what it does do, for good or ill, and I'm quite prepared to put my hands up on this, is it reorientates me towards feminist traditions of writing, principally, namely, parody, satire, and irony. So this is the bit where I have to acknowledge and recognise that my argument is actually a pretty tough sell, because weren't parody and irony always a bit dodgy as forms of criticism? They weren't reliable. They didn't always work. They're dubious forms of criticism. So, you know, and that happened, we knew that, we've known that, way before any of us thought that we might try and abandon criticism altogether. So why am I dragging us back to feminist forms of parody, satire, and irony? I'm not absolutely terribly sure, but I'll try and explain. the definitions, the differences, you know, that's not necessarily of interest. I think they're open to debate still. But the efficacy of these strategies rests arguably on conflict, on the degree to which they're able to introduce tension that is unresolvable, that is irreducible into a situation. Frederick Jameson saw that tension, regarded it in terms of critical distance from the text. Yeah? And they never did that in a reliable way. Yeah? So the communicative space of irony, the communicative space of parody, has always been unstable and remains unstable, even as the conditions of possibility for that kind of writing continue to emerge. So the fact that in the UK at the moment we now have, quite recently, copyright exceptions for parody, especially online forms of parody, isn't, for me, a stable indicator of either conservatism or creativity in cultural political contexts in which those two forces or impulses are enmeshed. You know, and they're particularly brought together through the dominance of concepts like innovation. Innovation is a resolution between the conservative and the creative. Now, in that kind of context, I think the work of parody and irony is important, even though it's unstable, even though it's unreliable, in the possibility of recreating tensions, basically, more or less. Yeah? So I'm advocating a strategy that is about recreating tension and conflict, however unreliably. It's a cultural political work that's vital, I think, even as it fails catastrophically, even as it goes wrong and the tension collapses and antagonisms become the sort of moralism that gives us non-ironic, ironic sexism and histories of misogyny, and that is a tough sell. I'm struggling to sell it to myself in some ways, but I think that's what it is. Right? So with my fingers crossed, as it were, what I'm arguing for is an antagonistic, a sort of impossibly post-dialectical, writerly feminism that is co-constituted by border states, by adversarial relations, and that foregoes final grounds in affirmation, in reparation, which I think for me too is a slightly paranoid response to critique as paranoia, and also in sustainability, and even in antagonism itself. Yeah? The end point is not antagonistic feminism as opposed to some other kind of feminism. I think when Chantal Mouffe comes up with that, she almost kind of shoots an otherwise great argument down by holding up an antagonistic feminism versus, you know, one characterized by a rational consensus, for example. It doesn't work. You don't arrive at an antagonistic feminism. You have to hold adversarial relations together irresolvably in tension. So sustainability doesn't quite work for me either, because it's predicated on limits that get overridden. I mean, Carol Stabile and Rosalind Gill, they make really powerful arguments for the unsustainability of the work that's being cut out for women in diverse contexts, in diverse worlds, in diverse ways, within a neoliberal economy, right? So if we find with the Laura Bates and the Anita Sarkeesian, who have really struggled and fought in these environments and caught up as Sarkeesian is in Gamergate, if we find that our capacity for endurance becomes limited, in a sense, by its underlying conditions of possibility, then I think probably feminism should reorient its strategic intent, creative, critical intent, towards, in a sense, simultaneously, I think this is what I mean, simultaneously, the endurability and the unendurability of these ubiquitous smart environments that we find ourselves scrutinized within. So that's by and large it. I do have these conclusions that might only take 5 minutes or so, but I think if I can do... Can I do... is there a time machine for women? What can writing still do? And the value of impossibly post-dialectical feminism in 5 minutes. I'll do it now. Is there a time machine for women? No. That was quick. It reminds me very much of Sisu's Life of the Medusa, where she says, well, we're caught between a rock and a hard place here. We're between the abyss and the Medusa. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here. Well, if only we could. If there was a magical time machine that went backwards and forwards in time, we'd have gone. Right? All gone. But what we have, maybe, is something provisional. In the ongoing boundary work, in the boundary states, the tension between a potential as managed and optimized time
and potential as time that is effectively unmanageable. Okay, so I've taken Isla and Jennifer and Janet and all the rest of them, and I've refigured them in the central character of this new novel that's been in progress for some time, and I imagine still will be if you ever see me in a year or so's time. Anyway, this novel in progress, it's called provisionally A Day in the Life of Janet Smart. It's a parody. And Janet's day is really, really quite a day. It's got lots of international travel. It's bending, stretching, creating dimensions in time. It's regulating her. It's extending her in time as time, yes? And through the extent to which she lives through this day, and I'm not quite sure yet that she does live through this day, but to the extent that she does, she becomes the agent of her own reconstitution as a political subject. And that reconstitution is premised on the tension between homo economicus, as Wendy Brown puts it, and its constitutive outsider. And that's where it hangs, as it were. What can writing still do? I think that's the question, you know, and I think it's a better question than what is writing. Although I note, with some interest actually, part of this book is a chapter on manifestos. Contemporary feminist and art manifestos that index videos and, you know, video stills and film stills and all the rest of it, they are still predominantly literally inscribed. They are actually written. So there's something in that. But I still, what I'm inheriting is this sense of what writing can do under conditions of possibility that would include the contemporary academy, and I've written about that in an article in New Formations relatively recently called Why Write. And what writing does as a kind of principal strategy of deconstruction, it destroys order and it creates openings to the political, albeit more or less. So we have this uncertain opening to politics foregrounded through strategies like parody and irony, which we know Mr. Mark sometimes fail to create tension, you know, reinforce sexism as much as they subvert it. But for me, you know, that uncertainty, I'll take it, yeah, in favour of an otherwise completely totalising scope of the neoliberal. And also, I think for me, the question of what writing can still do, it addresses the question that comes out of political theory, which is, what can we do? What do we do? And Sisu's answer to that question was right. So that still has a big impact for me. And post-dialectical feminism is impossible. Right? And it's as necessary, I think, is what I'm arguing. It's as necessary as it is impossible. There is no post-dialectical feminism. There is only, in a sense, a Derrida tongue twister, which is about trying to think a dialecticity of dialectics that is not itself dialectical. Okay, my brain just died, I think, at that point. But you see what he means, right? You can't do it, but you have to keep trying. And I think... I think what's happened is that we've either been trying too hard to do that, or we've not been trying hard enough. And I think the mistake is in thinking ourselves to be already post, meaning after, dialectics. And that's the mistake that I see spread across the media theory landscape at the moment in what I'm calling oops theory. So there is no necessary post-dialectical feminism, but there is this uncertain tension and opening to politics, which for me I will take over the pursuit of final grounds, basically, and that's it.
Thank you, Sarah. I feel weird tied to this table, but nonetheless. We have lots of time for questions. Would anyone like to get us started? And I just want to remind you to turn your microphone on when you do.
That picture you showed of the bra that's the most interesting device I've ever seen. What happens when some 12-year-old hacks into the software and?
I don't think you need to be a 12-year-old hacking into it. I think what's marvelous about such horrors, if you like, is I was hinting at before, is the fact that it probably, you know, like the chances of it working are probably about 1%. And you know, there are many contexts in which, you know, this is serious and also ripe for hacking, if you want, for messing around with. And I think, you know, that's one of the kind of key feminist strategies for you know, the absurd, the hubristic, the sexist claims that get made in these kinds of contexts is the first thing you will want to point out is that stuff doesn't work. Like, we've never been very good at doing intelligent technologies in a context in which we have never collectively, culturally decided what intelligence means. And the same problem persisted when we tried to build, you know, artificial life technologies, because, you know, even the biologists don't know what life is. So the idea of modeling it was always a little bit ambitious, shall we say. And although these smart technologies, they kind of correspond to a seemingly less overtly hubristic claim, because they're about kind of enhancing the, you know, bras and pants, things we know about, and environments, domestic environments, kitchens and tables and chairs. But they're not, you know, and they make absurdly totalizing claims. And I think that, you know, that whole kind of context of intelligent environments and smart environments is predicated on a claim that's very easy to pull down by pointing out that the technology itself invariably fails. And then you've got all sorts of inroads with, you know, messing about with those technologies. And, you know, I work also in the context of stuff on face recognition technology. And that's also great because, you know, it's very totalizing. It's all about surveillance. It's all about control. It's all about capture. But face recognition technology doesn't know what a face is. A computer doesn't know what a face is. It knows what patterns are. So if you hold a cardboard cutout of your face, it's really none the wiser. And it certainly can't deal with, you know, anything like facial hair or glasses or expressions that aren't completely standardized. And I think that kind of model of a failed technology doesn't preclude them being very powerful claims. And you know, that we should, I don't think we can afford to be dismissive, but I think we can afford to predicate critique on parody and pointing out that this stuff is wrought through failures.
Hi, thank you for your talk. It was really wonderful. Really enjoyed aspects of your critique or criticisms against Broad and Broady. And I was just wondering if you can expand a little bit about that, and also kind of how that sense of formation informs your thought for satire and irony as a mode or strategy of kind of having this sense of criticism within our work. But then I'm kind of thinking of the reality of that, of what that means in racialized bodies. And I can think of Mickey Kendall, who does that a lot through her Twitter feed and through her own blog sphere, but then is constantly attacked. And I think there's like informations or informings rather of her body as not deserving the kind of access to such formations or criticisms and use of irony.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the difference that I'm trying to mark is between strategies based on turns and oppositions. So suddenly we have to stop doing critique, and we have to think more about the creative, or we suspend our concerns with representation, for example, and we pursue instead a strategy predicated on performativity. It's not that there's not value in these other ways of looking. It's the replacement thing that I have trouble with, and I think it's unnecessary, and I think it's also unhelpful. So, for example, if you've got an object-oriented feminism, you're very much in line with the industry sell around objects as things in themselves. As you know, when we're talking about glass becoming its own subject, if you like, you know, that works very well for a kind of techno-capitalist push. If we're prepared to go along with, you know, it's all about the things in themselves. The environments will do the politics. The object will somehow write itself. The technology will somehow write itself. And we do this sometimes in the name of something really not very wise, which is to consider ourselves, because we know we're extended as human subjects, by technology, not least. So we tend to think of ourselves in terms of the post-human. Now, that's fine and great if you're talking about post-humanism as an extension of the human, as a differential relation between human and technology. It's not so great when you basically go for a teleology and you're talking about after the human. In whose interest is it to talk about after the human? You know, and who is it that's declaring this new world of imperceptible, invisible information infrastructures and algorithmic determinism? Who's doing all of that? It ends up being a kind of a case of a sort of resurrection of masculine disembodied knowledge practices invariably. You know, who can see the invisible? God. You know, it lands us back with precisely the problems that it claims to get us away from. I have no problem, as I've said, I contributed writing a book that was a very seriously vitalist or neo-vitalist account of mediation because I felt it was undeveloped, but it wasn't done in place of the usual critical gestures. I don't think we can afford to leave behind the usual critical gestures now, if ever, basically. So it's the oppositionalism that I'm trying to replace with intervention. And that notion of interventionism belonged, I think, to the critical tradition that we're trying to leave behind in some instances. You know, I think that's what it was for. I think deconstruction wasn't necessarily about, you know, just simply reversing binaries. Yeah? It wasn't about flipping a seesaw. It was about doing that, and then you move out into these kind of invented, you know, non-existent provisional contingent notions that get you some kind of grip onto politics, some kind of grip onto something you can do about it. And they're terribly flimsy in some ways, but they're also wonderful in their fragility, because that's basically, I think, what you get. That's as good as it gets. Interventionism, in a sense, from within. And I think this other question about who gets to speak, I think, is also really, really important. And we're in danger of not allowing ourselves to ask that question if we go for these moves, because there is no person speaking. It's the usual person who's speaking. It's the one true code, the one true voice. It's the usual. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your really thought-provoking
Can you turn your mic back on? I think you turned it off, Joe. Can you hit the button on the mic? I think you turned it off.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry. I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit about what you mean by writing. What do you mean by writing, especially in that world of with like this multimedia, right?
Sure.
With this glassy world, you know. Then that we can, you know, maybe we can think about your proposal about writing as this potential to create an opening.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, from a kind of the era of kind of critical thinking, we started to get a notion of writing that was extensive, that wasn't just about the word, it wasn't just about literal inscription, it was about code, it was about sculpture, it was about painting. It became a very expansive category, and I'm still interested in how writing, in a sense, means something non-identical in that way, but that it also retains its own specificity as literal inscription. And I just am noting for myself at the moment, as I was saying, in these contexts of manifestos, and manifestos being kind of new old provisional writing forms, publishing forms, that have a lot of currency at the moment, and a lot of people are interested in manifestos and pamphlets and booklets and things at the moment. And for I think, very clear reasons, a kind of a historical kind of analogue to times when, you know, you needed to make these kind of gestures and anti-institutional moves. And those forms even in the context of sort of feminist art manifestos, where we do have, as I say, multimedia, we do have all of that going on, and I, you know, I'm very interested in writing and in books that kind of explore those dimensions of multimodality. But let's not, you know, think that that happens in a sense at the expense of some old technology that was about inscription. You know, we don't always have to do away with old technologies for them to be reinvented in new contexts, in a sense. So I mean both, in a sense. I mean writing that isn't literal inscription, than that is. And you know, when I'm talking about what writing can do, I'm trying to hold both of those things together so that writing can be inclusive, but it's still quite specific. And I haven't figured out yet. I don't want to make a choice between those things, and I don't think we necessarily need to make a choice between those things. I mean, increasingly we are, you know, we're producing work that manages to cycle through those different forms of writing technology. And I think it's okay. I think we don't need to lose its specificity in order to stop it being, you know, a limited historical form or genre.
Thanks for your talk. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about parody as a kind of tactic. And I was thinking, so you don't think there's a time machine for women in the sense of being able to dodge the present, which I'm very sympathetic to. And I kind of like your idea of sort of a imminent antagonism as a way. But I wondered if you could say something about parody as a writerly tactic of what in another context I would think of as time machinics rather than a time machine. Because I'm sympathetic in some ways to your critiques of Braidotti and Gross, but I do think one of the things that's very interesting about that as a strategy and this interest in becoming and process and creativity, et cetera, is precisely that it tries to get to it not just as a kind of undifferentiated flow, although sometimes I think it goes that way, but rather to get to the question of the generative, the productive, the kind of imminent toehold that I think your work is also trying to get to as well. So I wondered if you could say something about that, because I'm thinking about something like Judith Butler's invocation of parody as kind of, this sort of force for breaking something apart to give also kind of a toehold of existence. But I wonder if you have a different sense of parody as a productive praxis.
I think it's sympathetic with both of those, and I think it kind of, for me, it sort of holds that hinge point together between those different perspectives on writing and on parody. But it's also, you know, for me it's very much a feminist strategy of finding critique through humour. So I want to, the element that I haven't thought enough about yet that I want to think about more is, again, something that we've talked about historically and I don't really hear so much at the moment, is on the value of humour as critique and creativity. And I'm with Braidotti on, on holding together, on being able to sort of talk about the nonsense of opposing critique and creativity, even as I think she then offers us a way of kind of moving away from critique and tries to sort of reframe it or move it from one context to another that happens to be referred to as being negative and affirmative. And it's that move that I'm not sure about. I don't feel that I have to think of parody as negative or affirmative, but I do think of it as doing work in between our ideas about the creative and the critical, and I think the work that it does, I actually trace back through more Haraway to Sisu. The work, now when I did that, it was really interesting, because obviously when we read the Cyborg Manifesto, it's so layered, and you get, every time you read it, you get something slightly different from it. And one of the interesting moves I was doing was going back through Haraway to Sisu on writing, and what's the difference for me, trying to understand the difference between what they, you know, the ways that they were handling writing as an interventionist technology. And of course for Sisu, it's downright destruction, because there was no room for feminine writing in a phallogocentric culture. And I wondered, you know, whether the move from Sisu to Haraway was about finding more of a space for parody as something other than, you know, rank destruction. And I think that she does, but I see one very much as continuous with the other one. And I think, you know, Haraway gets to humour through irony more than parody. And so again, that kind of, but has she also very much has her own way of defining irony as the sort of holding together of incommensurate things. And I felt that she'd really captured something about the tension in those writing strategies that I was trying to get at through her notion of irony. So I'm trying not to go for, in a sense, the definitions, the contested redefining and redefining of the terms. What I'm trying to go for is how they capture something that arises in political theory around antagonism and around conflict. But I am interested in pursuing where humour comes into that right now. So that's the kind of current project.
Thinking about, I like that very much. I'm over here.
Oh. Sorry.
I can time travel. No. I'm liking that very much. I'm sort of more a historian in a certain way, or sort of historiographer, but feminist queer historiography.
And I'm thinking about the pamphlet as exactly the site where humor becomes the place where power comes down. Like, power comes down on the very, very slippery ephemera writer, and it's both the ephemera writer, sorry, Mike, it's both the ephemera writer who is antagonizing power and the ephemera writer who is funded by power and is, like, creating false law or is creating false worlds and is creating false structures that are totalizing. And I don't know whether you wanted to tangle with the fact that in some ways humor is the most temporally elusive.
It is. I know I'm in trouble with this stuff. You know, I think because the work that it does is unstable, it's troublesome to be with. But I'm looking at that in context of what even unreliable tension, conflict, antagonism can do in contexts where politics, you know, is well, what a lot of people are talking about, you know, the end of politics and talking about the totalizing elements of the neoliberal, you know, if what's happening, and there's something that maps the kind of totalizing scope of this sort of technology, you know, it's everywhere technology, it's ubiquitous technology, it's got built within it this kind of universalizing, flat ontology claim. And within that, we have critical options, as it were, that kind of are about the generative and they are about the negative. But there's also always been this tension between the two. So how do we get to that tension between the two? And how far do parody and irony and humour do that or help us do that kind of work? But I think, too, they're very contextual because there are so many contexts in which it's not appropriate to go down that route. It just so happens that I find myself in contexts where it really is. You know, I work on astrobiology and the quest for life on Mars. I work on the notion of a smart toilet and talking bathroom mirrors. And, you know, it's kind of sitting there going, parody me, you know, laugh at me, laughing at you. And it's kind of, I can't somehow help myself. And I have to account for the legacy of work that's been done in those areas and what it can still do in those sorts of contexts, whilst recognizing that it will always be limited and that I'm already seeing it utterly collapse and utterly fail and make our lives worse. Sorry.
I want to ask a question, if that's all right. It seems to me that there is a lot of funny feminism all around us. And I'm thinking of Ayanna's question about black feminist Twitter and the work that Mickey Kendall is doing and the sort of feminist memes that are circulating. And so I'm kind of interested for you to sort of hear what you think about sort of what is going on with contemporary feminisms right now that are intervening in places we haven't seen before, unexpected places that are getting broad circulation, and things that are funny move and get shared. Right, and so those are modes of writing, but I'd say they're modes of writing, but I also think they're just modes of cultural production.
Yeah.
Right, that maybe writing doesn't fully capture,
sure,
but are deeply critical, sure. Also really funny, very derisive, often, yeah, forms of humor.
Yeah.
That I think are maybe making the kinds of cuts,
sure, sure,
you're trying to look for, but in places that, you know, again, that aren't maybe as sort of visible to our sort of normal ways of, or sort of historical ways of thinking about where feminist cultural,
yeah,
production happens, that we have to look at different sites. I'm just sort of interested in what you're thinking about contemporary feminisms,
yeah,
as doing some of this work,
I don't
work,
think I've been thinking about that enough. I think I, you know, in a sense, I'm aware of the kind of, you know, the slight upping of the ante that's been going on through kind of new forms of feminist publishing. I think new forms of feminist writing are kind of, you know, kind of emergent within that. And certainly expanding this category of writing, I think, is emergent within that. But I've actually been looking at where I think, you know, the opposite thing is happening,
yeah,
where I actually think that there's this kind of tendency to do something, and I want to shout, no, stop, you know, don't go there. And, you know, particularly in the context that I find myself, this kind of all too willingness to to abdicate somehow those kinds of strategies that you're talking about, which I agree are there, and are deployable and are part of a community of practice that, you know, I need to now sort of find and circulate and contribute to mobilizing. But I think the opposite tendency is so worrying and has so worried me in these contexts that I've been looking far more at that tendency to say, okay, well, look, we're post-human, and in these post-human contexts, right, you know, what does that do for us? And I'm thinking, disaster, that's what it does for you. It's absolute disaster, don't go there. You know, and it's got a lot to do with, you know, you can't do critique and you can't do writing and you can't even do an expanded notion of writing if you consider yourself to be after the human, because those are, you know, it's when people are arguing about let's get rid of narrative, let's get rid of representation, let's not do storytelling. And I'm thinking, do you know what Google does? You know, how do you see what Corning is doing? This is, you know, storytelling is still where governance is happening. So why on earth would we want to relinquish that? So yeah, then the next part of that is obviously to connect out to, and I've been doing more of a feminist genealogy on that, I think, going back to what Haraway says about writing, to what Sisu says about writing, and kind of pull that thread through to the present. And then, you know, connecting up with, you know, where, and I, you know, I work with people, I'm writing with people, including Joanna, including two colleagues of mine at Sussex, and I was telling you about this book that we're writing at the moment, that's really, you know, prepared to take it to another level, but without really quite knowing what that other level is, but having a kind of sense of where the real problems might be. And in terms of writing academic monographs, one of the problems is, you know, citation practices and, you know, and all those sorts of things that we were talking about yesterday. And so what can you do with that? You know, so these kind of very pulling out where the problems are and then kind of really seeing what you're prepared to do in relationship to this kind of set of critical and creative practices that you've inherited about, you know, a kind of boys' clubs of citation. And, you know, so what... I'll go as far as, I don't know, we seriously thought about leaving out all of the gender pronouns. Doing a Perec, you know, taking a whole book with no he in it, or a whole book that doesn't reference any work by men, and it's hard, actually, it's really just technically too difficult in the end. But, you know, there's kind of fine traditions of kind of ranting sorts of writing, polemical sorts of writing. How far can we go in context of, you know, and there are still real constraints there, even with the innovations and the interventions that are being made in feminist journal publishing, which I think are quite interesting. They're very, very interesting. But I still think that we're limited by conventions and traditions of publishing and what an article is and what a book is and what a student essay is, and we need to address all of that as part and parcel of it as well.
I want to thank Sarah. I know that there is a class coming in here at 6, apparently, which we just found out about. But we have a reception that's happening right outside in the hallway, and I hope you'll hang around. You'll ask more questions of Sarah and have some conversation. And thank you so much for coming, and thank you, Sarah,
thank you.
For a really stimulating conversation.